In the first installment of the Hiddenness series, we surveyed a few lesser-known arguments from Hiddenness. We looked at the work of Theodore Drange, Stephen Mateson, and Jason and John Marsh. If you haven't watched that video, you should click here. For this episode, though, I want to continue the series by unpacking the kind of leader of the pack for Hiddenness arguments. And here we're talking about J.L. Schellenberg's argument from Divine Hiddenness. My name is Justin Schieber. And this is Relay Theology. Now, since the 1993 publication of his Divine Hiddenness and Human Reason, philosopher J.L. Schellenberg's argument has received widespread attention. 3 decades later, the argument still generates deep engagement. And this is because many atheists find it to be quite powerful and persuasive, and many theists find it challenging and therefore worth responding to. Regardless of what one thinks of the ultimate soundness of the argument, it is undeniable that it has had a serious impact in modern philosophy of religion, and is therefore worth studying and understanding because of that impact. I'd also add that value can be found in any argument that touches on the amount of philosophically interesting concepts that this one does. And if that's not enough motivation for you, it is still worth studying if only to properly understand and clearly articulate why you disagree or agree with its conclusion. Now, in my view, the vast majority of the published objections to the argument fail to present a real challenge, as they appear, in my view at least, to be based on misinterpretations of the argument, while others suggest a need to either abandon the project outright or to make important modifications because of some alleged misstep in the argument. All that being said, here I want to present what I see as the bare skeleton of the argument, as well as some of Schellenberg's thinking in support of it. I intend this video, then, as a presentation of the argument and not a full-throated defense. Additional videos in this series will explore the argument deeper, using various popular and published objections as a kind of guide. It all begins with the concept of love. The concept can serve to distinguish certain attitudes or emotions or predispositions that persons can have about or toward other people, things, or experiences. No doubt there will be disagreements on exactly what the actual nature of love is. Few philosophically interesting concepts avoid that issue. However, by itself, this does not prevent us from saying anything meaningful, even if minimal, about the concept. Reflection on the nature of love, when it is directed at persons, reveals that it includes benevolence, where benevolence is construed as a kind of general goodness or giving disposition, but it does not stop there. Rather, person-directed love aims distinctly at personal relationships for its own sake. Those words, for its own sake, are key here, for the love that we have for our beloved is not reducible to a mere tool or practical means for benefiting them. My being in a loving relationship with my wife is not a mere means for bringing about additional ways for making her life better. The personal relationship is valued and sought for its own sake. Of course, this might include me doing things that I anticipate will improve her life, but that is not the point of the loving relationship. The loving relationship itself is the point. It is valuable for its own sake. Schellenberg points out that if loving relationships were only meant as a means for benefiting others, we would gladly step aside if somebody else made themselves known who could benefit our beloved even more than we could. But of course, that's absurd. And this is because loving another person distinctly entails an orientation toward being personally related with them in such a way as to share in their lives, to commune, to fellowship, to come close to the other. In addition, person-directed love is aimed at distinctly personal relationship because it alone provides the context in which benevolence can be most fully realized, enjoyed, jointly acknowledged, and appreciated by the participants whose well-being stands to benefit from it. aiming at just any sort of relationship here simply will not do. Instead, Schellenberg highlights the necessity of a personal relationship defined as, quote, a conscious and reciprocal relationship that is positively meaningful, allowing for deep sharing. Now, to be clear, we can provide gifts or valuable experiences from a kind of abstract, impersonal distance, but again, to think that's sufficient for loving a person is to, I think, fly past the point without so much as a wave. It fails to understand the distinctly relational element at the core of what it means to love another person. In light of this, I think we should also recognize that when you love another, you are at the very least minimally open to being in a relationship with that other, open to allowing the other to share in your life. Quote, one makes sure that there is nothing one ever does or fails to do that would have the result of making such relationship unavailable to the other, preventing her from being able to relate personally to one when she tries to do so. The claim that this sense of openness follows from loving another person is, I think, a very modest claim. And if you don't believe me, notice that being open in this sense is consistent with not begging, asking, or even suggesting that a relationship should occur. It just means the preservation of the opportunity for that relationship. It's even consistent with leaving it open to the beloved to take the first initial step toward the relationship's onset and its further development. To make the openness idea more real, suppose that Tim claims to love Sally. Now, if Schellenberg is right, Tim's claimed love for Sally means that Tim would, as far as he's able, ensure that nothing he does or fails to do makes it so that Sally cannot at least attempt to relate personally to Tim. Again, this is a very modest claim. Now, suppose, though, that Tim sprinted in the other direction every time Sally came within 50 feet of him, or imagine if, despite having all the free time in the world and the requisite resources, Tim never cared to even lift a finger toward being in close proximity to her or making his address, phone number, or email known to her. You'd think that Tim's use of the word love to describe his attitude toward Sally was deeply confused, and you'd be right about that. And that's because examples like this can help make it clear that one's openness to a relationship with a person is entailed by one's love of that person. Now, this seems correct so far, but some might still worry that this openness claim about the nature of personal love is still too strong. We can, after all, imagine a father who, after decades of searching, comes to learn of the whereabouts of his long-lost daughter and now has the ability to reveal his presence to her in the very next second. In doing so, he would make relationship with him available to her. But wait, what if he also knows that she's in the middle of an important once-in-a-lifetime moment, say she's singing the national anthem at the Super Bowl? Now, if that were true, then of course it would be the case that announcing to her that he is her father through the PA system or showing up on stage would potentially destroy the focus that she needs to perform well. Knowing these possible consequences, the father might reasonably wait, thereby preventing her from entering a personal relationship with him until after the performance, and so essentially being closed to that personal relationship for some time. And while it's certainly true that we finite persons cannot always accommodate the consequences of our openness, like the father and the famous pop star daughter, God suffers from no such restriction. We can therefore set this worry aside, for while it highlights an interesting fact about love between finite persons of limited resources, it is ultimately irrelevant in contexts that are concerned with an unlimited and personally loving God. A key part of the hiddenness argument is, of course, the concept of God that it addresses, right? So Schellenberg's idea of ultimism comes into play here. For Schellenberg, the label refers to, quote, the more general religious idea of a reality that is triply ultimate, metaphysically, axiologically, and soteriologically. No doubt there are a variety of ideas, of religious ideas, that could play the role that ultimism identifies, and no doubt some of them are more deserving of attention than others. My point here is that we want to look at God as conceived of as the personal version of the ultimate, That is, we want to look at God as conceived of as a person who is metaphysically, axiologically, and soteriologically ultimate. Now, if we're interested in doing this right, though, if we're interested in using philosophy to find out what is true, rather than maintaining belief in our current tradition or lack thereof, we need to be mindful to avoid theological notions from the actual world that don't clearly unfold from the concepts that we are analyzing. Schellenberg writes, quote, "We have, all of us, been influenced by the many attempts to make God fit the actual world. Theology starts off by accepting that God exists and so has to make God fit the world, in a way that is its job. But our job, as philosophers, faced with the question of God's existence, is to fight free from distractions of local and historical contingency, to let the voice of authority grow dim in our ears, and to think for ourselves about what a God and a God-created world would be like." Now, one thing to note here is that because a personal ultimate is metaphysically and axiologically ultimate, not only has God existed causally prior to all non-divine reality, but as Schellenberg puts it, quote, "unsurpassable metaphysical goodness is already realized in God." Now, many, including myself on this channel, have raised the question in the past of what could possibly motivate such a being to create. However, that investigation can be set aside here. We will be assuming, without good reason, that if God existed, God would create something. We might also point out that the axiological ultimate, if a person, will be an unsurpassably great person. Theists will have no problem following this line of thought, right? Philosophers, and certainly theistic philosophers, have long agreed that, for example, power in persons is of exceptional value. And so an unsurpassably great person must be unsurpassably powerful too. Now, if we continue with that same line of reasoning, we will notice that the same can be said of knowledge in and of persons and moral goodness in and toward persons. However, love, I think, deserves a place at the conceptual table too. An unsurpassably great person would be unsurpassably loving toward any existing person. God, the unsurpassably great person, will be perfectly loving toward any existing finite persons. Okay, so this is as good a time as any to actually look at the argument itself. Now, as each premise is stated, try to avoid doing yourself the disservice of rejecting as useless that which is less than 100% certain. Right? So conditional in form, the first premise of the argument reads as follows. 1. If a perfectly loving God exists, then there exists a God who is always open to a conscious reciprocal relationship with any finite person. Now, the key pieces standing in support of this premise have already been laid out in earlier sections, right? We've just got to snap them together, essentially. Earlier, I noted that Schellenberg claims openness to a personal relationship is included in what it means for a person to love another person, with the only exception being irrelevant to our aims here. Recall that it is in the very nature of love to value personal relationships for their own sake, and this must surely be the case with an unsurpassably loving being too. We can now combine that insight, though, about the nature of person-directed love with what we have been able to discover about personal ultimism, right? So we've discovered that personal ultimism, or God, is perfectly loving toward all persons that exist. Now, if we combine these insights, if we snap them together, we end with, at the very least, an openness to a personal relationship being entailed by what it means for an unsurpassably loving person to love another finite person. This very modest claim seems correct. After all, Schellenberg writes, quote, "How could God at some time count as loving John or Joan as fully and richly as God can if God at that time is preventing John or Joan from being able to participate in any way in a meaningful conscious relationship with God?" So we expect this perpetual openness in cases where mere limited humans love one another, and so it is appropriate, I think, to do so in the case of a God who is claimed to be unsurpassably loving toward persons, and capable of accommodating any and all consequences of any resulting relationship. Premise 2. If there exists a God who is always open to a conscious, reciprocal relationship with any finite person, then no finite person is ever non-resistantly in a state of non-belief in God. So here we've taken the consequent of one and pushed it a step further to reach an interesting claim about belief, namely that God's openness entails that all finite persons are in possession of belief in God, except for those who are resistant. But how did we get here? Well, the basic idea is pretty intuitive. It seems clear that one cannot be in a conscious, reciprocal relationship which allows for sharing with another person unless one believes that the other person exists. Without such belief, a relationship of the relevant sort could not even get off the ground. The other concept introduced here first by this premise is non-resistance and its implied opposite, resistance. These are just as they sound. We are assuming, for the sake of the argument, that God has created, and that he's created persons, some of which are capable of participating in personal relationship with God. Persons may, according to their natures, behave in a variety of different ways, though, in different circumstances, right? So we might assume that among their capacities is the ability for self-deception. If person A wanted a relationship with person B, but person B wanted nothing to do with them, perhaps person A would engage in kind of sour grapes thinking and convince themselves of a mistruth. For example, in this case, they might convince themselves that they never actually wanted person B in the first place because B has some undesirable flaw that they've just made up or they've decided to emphasize over all else. Now, if that's possible, could they, if sufficiently motivated, not also convince themselves of other mistruths by way of self-deception, say that God does not exist? To accommodate this possibility, the premise must have a qualifier which restricts the guaranteed belief in God to those who have not, through resistant self-deception, cut themselves off from any kind of potential relationship with God, convincing themselves that atheism is true in a world where God exists. Schellenberg writes, quote, "The presence of God will be for them like a light. However much the degree of its brightness may fluctuate, remains on unless they close their eyes." To repeat, the only way the fact of God's reality fails to make it from the external world into their own internal representation of it is through willful resistance. Without resistance, all would be in possession of belief, for only then would they be in a position to enter the relevant sort of relationship with God. Premise 3. Therefore, if God exists, there are no non-resistant non-believers. Premise 4. There are or have been non-resistant non-believers. The very modest claim here is that of the billions of people that are known to have lived lives in the actual world, there are or have been persons that have failed to believe in God, but not as the result of their own resistance. While those with no interest in meeting with or valuing others outside of their narrow tribe may be eager to dismiss the self-reports of non-believers as morally other, or the descriptions of pre-monotheistic peoples as defective, I suspect most will follow reason where it leads here and recognize that non-resistant non-believers do in fact exist. Therefore, the conclusion we reach is no perfectly loving God exists. Now, a look at the argument reveals that it is deductively valid. The question then becomes whether the premises are true. If you're a theist, you'll of course want to reject one or more of the premises. There are a number of ways to do this, right? Take your pick, there are a number of premises. That said, it's not as easy as it may initially seem. The argument is often subject to misinterpretation, or put less charitably, misrepresentation. Now, because of that, I do want to make a few clarifications. One involves the way by which the non-resistant would be met with the provision of theistic belief. The suggestion here should not be understood to involve only vast and dramatic public signs or wonders. No, Schellenberg is explicit that there are a variety of ways available to God to ensure belief for the non-resistant. God could, in his infinite wisdom, tailor the most subtle form of religious experience to an individual's epistemic needs. Innate beliefs are another way that this could be done. Moreover, Schellenberg's claim that the non-resistant would have belief does not suggest that all would be in possession of direct, explicit experience of God or a felt presence of God at all times. The experience of God and belief in God, it must be understood, are distinct concepts here. just as we don't fail to believe in the existence of our coworkers when they fly off for a week's vacation, we don't need constant experiential interaction with God in order to maintain belief in God. Indeed, we might expect that God would use experiential distance to make a moral point when we act entitled or express improper self-importance in the face of a divine human relationship. God may also use such experiential distance to preserve our freedom to make choices without constantly feeling as though there's a pair of divine eyes watching our every move in judgment, right? So that's the argument. Again, this video was not meant as a full defense or even a full endorsement of the argument. Stay tuned to the channel and we will look at some of the most common popular objections to the argument, as well as some of the strongest published objections to the argument in the literature. Please hit like and subscribe to keep up with future content. Music is by Casserole, a Chicago-based band and used with permission. If you appreciate the content and the tone of what Relay Theology has to offer, please take a moment and leave a review on iTunes. You can support us directly by making a small recurring donation to our Patreon for early access to our content. Comments, questions, criticisms, or requests can be sent in audio form to relaytheology@gmail.com for possible inclusion in future episodes. Special thanks to our patrons, Charles Hoffer, Tyler Bimrose, Jason, Robin Willems, Ed Atkinson, Kim Bichkovsky, Anthony Lawson, Jeff Rubinoff, and Brandon McCleary.